Buenazo. So this morning I discussed ways of taking one's pulse, especially in terms of emotions, just how we're doing emotionally from a morning to an afternoon, from day to day, and then applying any one of the four measurables appropriately. And this afternoon, as we're now kind of looking ahead in our final week, looking ahead to transition, we're aware that, you know, in the kind of the Western dichotomy of heart and mind, well, the heart, well, we've kind of dealt with that, sublime qualities of the heart. And then we have the mind, and so to speak a bit more technically, the issues this morning were more about emotion, but we also have cognitive ups and downs, as we all know. And so as we look at the array of meditative practices, of shamatha practices in particular, that we've been exploring over the last 7 weeks, there's clearly a gradient. And once again, especially if you become familiar with all of them, then you can choose them also from day to day, depending on just your cognitive state, what's most appropriate, right? And so I'm sure for a lot of you, I think most of you, you'll be venturing from here on Friday to a more active, socially engaged way of life, in which case the shamatha can be really a way of maintaining balance. I think there are some engines that self-tune, or it seems to me that something like that, but in any case, it's a way to maintain the tuning, the cognitive balance, the attentional balance of your mind from day-to-day situation to situation. Bearing in mind, we can also do those little mini sessions of 30 seconds here, a minute there. So what I'm getting at is we start from the beginning, the infirmary, and that is, it could happen sometime after Friday or after Thursday that whether at the end of the day or even before, maybe it's been one of those kind of rough days, emotionally turbulent, really draining. Maybe you've met very difficult people, difficult situations. And so let's say at the end of the day, but really only like 8 o'clock, but your work is finished, and you just kind of feel beat up, right? Emotionally drained, maybe stressed out. Maybe there was an argument. Maybe somebody was really difficult with you, and so on. And so there you are, and it's only 8 o'clock, and you're not really sleepy yet. But your mind, your body doesn't feel very good, and your mind doesn't feel very good. It's stressed. It's tight. It's constricted. And so at that point, there's the left road and there's the right road. And that is for those who are really primarily accustomed to pursuing hedonic well-being, equating that with a good life, then that's exactly the time to go get a beer, watch some television, kick back, read a magazine, chat, listen to nice music, and so forth. But have something come from outside, something hedonic, some kind of stimulation to help you kind of ease off, relax a little bit, find some happiness, and so forth. Television, radio, internet, all of those kind of things readily come to mind. And so that will clearly be still an option, okay? And likewise, weekends. A lot of people, by the time Friday comes around, then they kind of just feel that way cumulatively, you know, through the weekday, and it comes Saturday morning. Time to, what used to be Sabbath, the time to really, you know, devote oneself to Dharma practice, becomes a time for everything else, just kicking back, enjoying sports, television, whatever. Or the alternative, an alternative, of course, is, for example, at the end of the day, when the mind is scattered, it's agitated, and is also stressed out, just really fatigued, a lot of wear and tear. I wouldn't be surprised if, on that occasion, the image comes to mind of you sitting upright, really, and like really in bhaka, really, really good posture, you know, maybe all seven points, and then applying yourself assiduously to meditation. When you're really feeling beat up, drained, exhausted, and stressed out, that very image may make you recoil. Like, give me a break. What part of I'm exhausted, stressed, unhappy, and drained, and tight don't you understand? Right? And so that may not be really an option that you would actually go for. Whereas, when you're feeling just exactly the same way, if the image comes to mind of going into your bedroom with a really soft light, just very soft and soothing light, warm but not cloyingly warm, not too warm, and lying just on top of your bed with a nice pillow beneath, and then just going into complete meltdown in the Shavasana, just arms out to the side, and just total surrender, and then allowing your body to totally come to rest in its natural state, and then saying, oh, here's the breath, and the breath was so tends to be so caught up when we're ensnared by emotions, hopes, fears, frustration, resentment, and so forth, and letting the respiration settle, and then letting the mind settle. And that is all the concerns about the day that just went by. That day is finished. Snip, release the past. Tomorrow brings its own troubles. Snip, release tomorrow. And just be right there in your room, lying on your back, totally at rest. Body, speech, and mind settle in the natural state. And then for some time, just be present in your body with this nice diffuse, but present and clear awareness, and experiencing the sensations of that ebb and flow, that in and out flow of the breath, the sensations corresponding to the breath throughout the body. That image may not be daunting, intimidating, a turnoff. It might be, that's a nice option. Better that than maybe watching television or the other kind of habitual responses to such stress and fatigue. So that's what I'm proposing here. And that is when you kind of just feel really drained, tight, wound up, and so forth, that first gear, that infirmary, full body awareness, preferably in the infirmary, and that total relaxation can be really just what the doctor ordered. So that's one possibility. If you feel a little bit more energy, of course you can do that in the sitting position. Why not? You know. Now, on other occasions, so let's just imagine different scenarios for different days. On other occasions, it may not have been a terribly stressful day, really emotionally or psychologically or in terms of your nervous system, really draining, stressful, and so forth, but just a lot of stuff going on. That can happen. And you may be on top of it, but it's just one thing after another, and there you are, like a surfer riding a really rough wave, and a lot of up and down, but kind of handling it on top of the situation. But by the time you come to the end of the day, your mind is so filled with just so many thoughts and concerns, and a lot of those from today will be relevant for tomorrow, so you'll be anticipating tomorrow, the next week, and so forth. And so you may not feel particularly stressed or drained or tight, but more like the mind is bubbling with rumination. I don't know if you've ever experienced that, but you know, if you do, should that come up, you know? So we just knocked off stress, you know, that real tightness and so forth, but just mere agitation, lots of rumination, bubble thoughts. For that, in the supine position or the sitting, you know what's coming. Second gear, rise and fall of the abdomen. Grounding, soothing, and with every out-breath releasing, but gently arousing the attention as you breathe in, but that deep release as you breathe out. And in a very gentle way, calming, soothing the turbulent mind, stabilizing it, stilling it, can be very nice, very pleasant, and not too difficult, not too demanding, and a really nice option to the more hedonic ways of dealing with agitation. So there's second gear. On other occasions, at the end of the day, it might just be a pretty normal day. At the end of the day, the work is done. You still feel quite fresh. The mind is just normally agitated, but nothing special. Not particularly stressed out. Then the notion that even sitting quite upright, or supine if you like it, you can always do that. But sitting upright, and now because the mind is relatively balanced, nothing really bad going on, it's just kind of normal. Then third gear, right there at the apertures of the nostrils, arousing and releasing, and then as the whole system calms down more and the sensations of the breath become subtler and subtler, then of course the mind becomes vivider and vivider, then all good. So there are the first three modes, first, second, third gear. And each of those, then, as you're taking your pulse cognitively and in terms of your nervous system, the overall balance of the mind, if you try to take on one that is kind of beyond your reach at that time, then you might just find it frustrating, right? Whereas if you take one on, it's right where you are, you know, what's the level of agitation, stress, and so forth and so on, then you might feel, just the medicine the doctor ordered, right? So now on top of that, if your body feels quite at ease and you really want this, the mind feels quite at ease, pretty stable, really not bad, relatively clear, pretty fresh, maybe it's Saturday afternoon, maybe you'll be fortunate enough to have that quality of mind during the weekdays. But if it feels pretty good and you're accustomed to, you have the real taste of settling the mind in its natural state, good. If you can do that and find that you're not seizing up, you're not tensing up, You're not kind of feeling high-strung as a result of facing into the wind of all the thoughts, emotions, memories, and so forth. Very good. Why not? Why not? And of course, doing that not only at the end of the day, but interspersing that as you season the day for 30 seconds here, a minute there. It's just a wonderful way to come back to center, to come back to that composure, that stillness, that clarity, which is really a hallmark of sanity. And then all the more so, if you really just feel very balanced, pretty calm, pretty fresh, relaxed, really relaxed in body and mind, then why not? Go for awareness of awareness, off into fifth gear. Awareness of awareness. And again, having that confidence, not because somebody else told you that you're doing okay, but because you know yourself, that when your awareness is holding its own ground, that's not some extraordinary accomplishment, realization, and so forth, but it is something that you don't need somebody else's assurance whether you can do it or not. It's one of those things that you can know inside, and I think many of you already do. And so I won't give the finger snap again and again. We've been there and done that. But just at a moment's notice, I really want to kind of snap my fingers, you can just be right there and say, yeah, this is it. This is it. There I am. I'm not talking about it. I mean, I'm talking, but when you're just resting, you don't need to talk. But you have that from within confidence. That yes, my awareness is holding its own ground. It's resting in its own place. It's still, it's clear, it's relaxed, it's loose, it's free of grasping. Right now. Yes, I know that. If somebody else tells me I'm wrong, they're wrong. Because I know that. I know that. I know it from my own experience. And so it's really so helpful, not only to do the practice right, but to know you're doing it right. To be aware, resting in awareness, and know that you're resting in awareness. That gives you that internally generated confidence that's not hinged upon somebody else giving you the thumbs up or the thumbs down or wobbly, wobbly thumb. Who knows? I don't know what's going on. And so there's just straight awareness of awareness, resting in the sheer luminosity, the sheer cognizance of awareness itself. But now let's come back to, now that we've gone through the whole, all five gears, right? Now let's come back to that beautiful synthesis that I read, what, a week ago or so? From the Pinchen Rinpoche, the fourth Pinchen Rinpoche, from the 17th century. Where there's the common ground. The common ground is your awareness resting in its own place, holding its own ground. And then either just resting there and immediately releasing thoughts, and I'll use very few words because you know what I'm going to say. There's that option, that is the dual option, the flicking away, the deflection of thoughts immediately, and just resting in utter simplicity. Or that possibility, more in a kind of a Mahamudra Dzogchen style of without affirmation, without rejection, without embracing or kicking away, just letting be, letting thoughts arise, noting them, but without any strong interest, right? Just noting them. But as you're noting them, not moving, not veering, not moving away from your awareness holding its own ground. So you simply note things coming up, but you don't budge. You don't move. You just let them be. And you know that just by noting them, they will dissolve of their own accord. They don't need any special antidote. You don't really need to deflect them. They will dissolve of their own accord. So we have those two methods. Those two methods, right? Now within that, because I know a lot of you have really quite rich backgrounds before you ever came here, so your shamat is simply whatever I've been able to share with you that's beneficial, is there only to augment, to be of service to, what you already have, right? And certainly not to suggest this is some new path. Heavens forbid, you know? But there it is to serve you in you know, if you're Vipassana practice, or state of regeneration, or Lam Rim practice, or Dzogchen, Mahamudra, whatever. Clearly, a mind that is relaxed, stable, and clear is going to be better one than one that is contrary, right? But now, if you have a rich background, for example, some of you may have studied Madhyamaka, studied the perfection of wisdom, the Heart Sutra, and so forth, and really have some good background, some real, genuine, authentic understanding of this middle way view of how all phenomena are, in the same breath, empty of inherent nature and do arise as dependently related events. So Nagarjuna's central theme, that these are really two ways of speaking of the same reality, empty of inherent nature. And because they're empty of inherent nature, they arise as dependently related events. Because phenomena arise as dependently related events, therefore, they're empty of inherent nature. So, as I mentioned, in the Galupa tradition, they'll study that theme for 4 years, full time, 4 years. I don't know exactly the curriculum among the Nyingma and the Kagyu Kempos or the Sakya Geshes, but if they're doing 10, 12 years of training, I strongly suspect, pretty educated guess, they're probably spending a year or two just focusing on that. Chandakirti, Madhyamaka Vatara, Perfection of Wisdom, Diamond Cutter Sutra, and so forth. There are many, many great classic treatises on this Madhyamaka view, middle way view. And so by that, one gains a conceptual understanding first, and then as one goes deeper, then it becomes more of a meditative experience. As one goes deeper, it becomes realization. You actually perceive it, right? So if you have at least conceptual understanding, but maybe better, some experience, some taste of emptiness, and now what I'm really getting at is emptiness of your own awareness. Emptiness of your own awareness. If you have that, if you have from your prior study, your reflection, teachings you receive from lamas, question and answer, meditating and so forth, if you already have some insight, some experiential insight into the emptiness of inherent nature of your own awareness, then when you're resting there in awareness of awareness, there's no reason to hold back. Like, oh, okay, I'll pretend that my awareness is inherently existent even though I know it's not. That would be silly, right? So whatever insight you have, of course, why not? Why not be one of those extraordinary beings who is simultaneously cultivating vipassana and shamatha? Why hold back? If you have that ability, why restrain yourself? You know? And so, if you have that insight, then as you're just resting, letting awareness hold its own ground, then let that awareness be imbued with your insight into the emptiness of that very awareness itself. In which case you will proceed along the path of shamatha, but as you do so, your insight into the empty nature of awareness itself will become deeper and deeper and deeper. So on that theme, I thought I'd bring in just something a little bit from outside here, because it's so, I found it so useful. It was actually the first time that I ever translated for Gyatso Rinpoche back in 1990. He specifically asked me to come with him down to Southern California to one or Kagyupa Center. And there he taught two chapters from a classic text from the Beiyul tradition of the Nyingma lineage. But the Beiyul is right there on the cusp between Kagyu and Nyingma, between Mahamudra and Dzogchen. It integrates the two. So Tukur Ugyen Rinpoche, Chukyi Nyima Rinpoche, Tsognyi Rinpoche, Mingyur Rinpoche, they're all exactly of that continuum, of that lineage. And my own teacher, Gyatso Rinpoche, my own lama, he is a lineage holder of that tradition. That is, within the Nyingma, he is of the Beiyul tradition. So he passed that on. I was his interpreter. And so, out of this a great big commentary on the union of Mahamudra and Dzogchen, then Kamachame Rinpoche, also from the 17th century, and also had a connection with the Dalai Lama, something like a consultant, doctrinal consultant, secondary tutor, something like that. So all the same generation, 17th century, Dalai Lama, Kamachame Rinpoche, Penchen Rinpoche, all in the same team. So I like that, I must say. So Gyatso Rinpoche picked out these two chapters out of a very, very large text. I think it was something like chapter 15 and 16. And that follows all the preliminary practices and then boom, into shamatha, into vipassana, and then onto Mahamudra and Dzogchen. In his chapter, I've just now read through again his chapter on shamatha, quite brilliant, and then onto the chapter in vipassana. But that's not published yet. Later, he taught this text, which I translated as A Spacious Path to Freedom, also the union of Mahamudra and Dzogchen. That you can see. That's A Spacious Path to Freedom. And his chapter on Vipassana there is very clear. And he makes a really interesting comment. I mean, many. It's a brilliant chapter and tremendous erudition, kind of jaw-dropping erudition, because he shows such familiarity with the whole canon of sutras, of Mahayana sutras from the Tibetan, originally from Sanskrit, and then the great Indian commentary literature, and then the commentary literature from the various Karmapas and other great adepts of the Kagyu tradition and so forth. So he just does that, he's like an accordion. He goes right back to the teachings of the Buddha and then draws it right out through the Mahasiddhas of India, the Mahasiddhas of Tibet, the Kama, especially the Kama Kagyu tradition, and then right on to his own gurus and so forth. But the point there that I found so intriguing, and when Gyatso Rinpoche first taught it to me, I must say I really was quite captivated, is that Kamachame Rinpoche, being this tremendous scholar himself, I mean, he was one of the greats of that generation, he makes a comment about realizing emptiness. And that is, he said, there are two approaches. And one approach is following Nagarjuna and the other great adepts of the Madhyamaka tradition, then investigating a wide variety of phenomena, of matter, of space, of time, of all kinds of appearances, of abstracts and tangibles, of the body, mental states, and so forth and so on. And one by one, as you investigate one type of phenomenon after another, one class of phenomena after another, by probing into it, this ontological analysis, it's called, Dundambe Chepa, by this ontological analysis, then realizing one by one that each class of phenomena is empty of inherent nature. But for example, a molecule is very different from time. Time is very different from space. Space is very different from justice. Justice is very different from, the list goes on and on. But one by one, just thoroughly, in a very naturalistic kind of way, just checking through the various components of the universe, and one by one, and seeing that all of them, they just all fall. They fall under this onset or this assault of the Madhyamaka analysis. None withstand analysis, all prove to be or reveal their nature as empty of inherent nature. So he said there's one approach, and eventually, and within that, of course, you'll get to the mind and realize the empty nature of your mind as well, the empty nature of consciousness itself. That too has no inherent existence. So that's included. And then he said, and then there's another approach. That one, and he said, that one takes a lot of time because you have to be very thorough, make sure you didn't miss anything. It's kind of like, okay, is there anything here? Almost like in a dream, if you're in a lucid dream and you're engaging in that second phase of lucid dreaming of transformation and emanation. Well, if you want to be very thorough, then you'll be checking out all kinds of things, whether anything there in the dream is resistant to transformation by your own mind, whether it seems to be existing from its own side, and then you probe into that until you see, ah, yes, that too is utterly malleable. That too has no existence from its own side, right? So, for example, trying to walk through a wall. The first time you try it, you might get stuck or bounce off and so forth, but as you probe more deeply into it while in the lucid dream, then before long, you can just walk right through it, right? Because you have realized, since you've realized that it's not really there from its own side, you walk right through it. But it appears to be there from its own side, and when you still kind of grasp onto it as such, and I think I've mentioned this before, because Stephen LeBerge and some of my own students have tried this, if they haven't quite got it, they will try to walk through the wall and then get halfway through and get stuck, you know, as if they're kind of caught in jello, and they can't quite move forward and get a little roar like that, you know, kind of uncomfortable. So I won't elaborate on that point, but the point there in emanation and transformation, this phase of dream yoga, now this is classic Tibetan Buddhist dream yoga, is that you check out everything. Can you walk on water? Can you walk through fire? Can you fly through the air? Can you go through the earth? Can you transform one into many, many into one, the tall into the small, into the short, the big into the small, and so forth? Is there anything you can't do? And when you see there's nothing I can't do, it's all malleable, then you see, okay, well, in that case, through experience, nothing here has its own inherent identity that is immutable, resistant to my altering it with my own mind. So you become a great magician, a great sorcerer, a mahasiddha, right, in the dream. So there's one approach. And likewise, for the Madhyamaka analysis of phenomena, you can do the same thing. Explore the wide range of phenomena one by one to see if any of them are resistant to that ontological probe, really have something from their own side existing by their own inherent nature. There's one approach. Then he says there's another approach. While that one's the approach of great scholars, people with a lot of time, people willing to do a very elaborate search, there's another approach, right? And he said, this is our approach. This is the Mahamudra approach. Okay, now, he's a patriarch and adept of both Mahamudra and Dzogchen, speaks with consummate authority for both. He said, our approach is we go just right into the nature of awareness. We take that. Make a beeline for awareness itself. Now, if you've already practiced shamatha without a sign, you know the target. You know what to attend to. You know what it's like to be aware of awareness. So you don't kind of, oh, what's awareness? Gee, I wish I knew. No, you hone in on it. Just like a bee coming to a flower, you can find it. You rest there. You know what you're doing. This is awareness of awareness. Now that you are aware of being aware, you're on target, so to speak. Then you apply analysis, investigation, you probe in. And he shows some of the classic procedures for probing right into the nature of awareness itself to see whether or not it has some nucleus, some essence, some inherent nature of its own. So he said, that's our approach, is having noted the conventional nature of consciousness, which the Benjin Rinpoche and Dujum Lingma and so many others say, oh, the conventional nature of consciousness, that you get just by practicing shamatha without a sign, or awareness of awareness, then you know what consciousness is. But now that you know what consciousness is, then you probe into its ultimate nature, its empty nature, right? Its absence of inherent nature. So he said, this is our approach. Upon the basis of shamatha, then we apply vipassana first and foremost, and above all, right into the nature of awareness itself, to realize the emptiness of awareness itself. He said, once you've cracked that one, once you've gotten the taste, gained a realization or insight into the empty nature, the shunya nature, not the mere vacuity, that's good stuff, but the emptiness of inherent nature, inherent identity, of your own awareness, he said, then, from that basis, having that certitude, that decisive insight into emptiness of your own awareness, then when you turn your awareness out to the appearances and objects to awareness, they fall really easily. They fall really easily. And that it's quite not all of them all at once, so it's not just like a one-step deal, but now that you realize the emptiness of awareness, then it comes quite readily. That is the realization of the emptiness of all objects of awareness and all appearances to awareness. They're all appearing and yet empty. And it's very easy to realize. Okay? So that's the more direct way. It's not to say realization of the emptiness of awareness is easy, but it is direct without elaboration. And by realizing that, you readily realize the emptiness of everything that you're aware of, all appearances and all objects. So he gives us an analogy for this. Two ways of taking a tree, a living tree, and turning it into firewood. Firewood. And for firewood, of course, you need dry wood. So he said, okay, here's one approach. Get out your pruning shears, and then just start pruning away. The tree has a lot of leaves on it, a lot of branches. Get out your pruning shears. And clip by clip by clip, prune off all the leaves, all the living twigs. Just like basically suffocating the tree to death, you know, and so that it has no more twigs, and then it dries up. Having cut off all the branches and all the twigs and all the leaves, then the tree dries up, right? And having dried up, now you've got some dry wood, and you can make some firewood, and there you go. Mission accomplished, snip by snip, right? There's one approach. And the other approach is come to the tree and whack its taproot, sever its taproot, go down beneath the soil and just hatchet it, cut all the way through with one stroke or however many strokes it takes, but cut the taproot, the primary root of the tree, without ever touching all the leaves and all the branches and all of that, just cut its taproot. And by that one severance, the whole tree will dry up and you will achieve the same thing, but much more direct, much more direct. So it's a powerful analogy, and you've immediately seen how it relates to the two previous ways of realizing emptiness. So one way or another, if you have, by the elaborate route or the more concise, concerted assault on the grasping onto the inherent nature of your own awareness, if you've broken through that and realized emptiness, then by all means, following this practice of the Benchen Rinpoche, of holding awareness, holding its own ground, but imbue that with the realization or insight into its emptiness of inherent nature, then you've definitely, now you're practicing the fusion of shamatha vipassana. Fantastic. Much more powerful. Much more powerful. Right? Now, on the basis of that, if you've not only realized the emptiness of your own of your own awareness, which is empty like every other phenomenon, it's no more empty, no less empty, it's just empty of inherent nature. If you realize not only that, but you've studied the Dzogchen view, you've practiced the meditation, you've engaged in the Dzogchen way of life, perhaps received pointing out instructions and had careful, sustained guidance by a qualified Dzogchen master. If through all of that, whether it took months, years, or decades, if you have some authentic insight, taste, realization of rigpa, of unconditioned awareness, in the fourth time, unborn, unceasing, non-local, non-individuated, of the nature of innate bliss. If you've tasted that, then when you're practicing Pinjin Rinpoche's method of resting in awareness, of course, if you've realized rigpa, of course you've realized emptiness, the emptiness of awareness, because there's no way you can realize rigpa while still reifying your own awareness. That's not possible, and all schools agree on that, right? So if you've not only realized the emptiness of your awareness, but you've also broken through tekchir, broken through even the conventional grasping onto your own awareness, broken through that, shattered that, and broken through to the unconditioned awareness, which in the new translation schools is called the innate mind of clear light. In Tsongkhapa's tradition and other traditions, it comes up especially in the stage of completion practices. The innate mind of clear light, the very subtle mind conjoined with the very subtle prana or energy. If you've realized that, well then my goodness, don't hold back. And that is when you're doing this simple practice, you've turbocharged it once with the realization of the emptiness of your own awareness, and then you've turbocharged it again by breaking through and actually realizing rigpa. But then your shamatha is not only shamatha vipassana, but it's also dzogchen, meditation, and there you are resting in rigpa. And then sustaining that, then the natural qualities of stability and vividness naturally emerge from rigpa. You don't look for shamatha outside of rigpa any more than you look for bodhicitta outside of rigpa, because rigpa is the wellspring of all virtues, of all the paramitas and so forth. So if you have such profound realization, not only having identified awareness, not only having realized the emptiness of your own awareness, but also broken through to rigpa, then by all means, don't hold back and practice that. Now just a final comment, and that is, this is quite a profound realization. His Holiness Dalai Lama, when he has taught Dzogchen quite a number of times now, received teachings from Dingo Kenzin Rinpoche and Kenpo Jime Punso and so forth. I don't know all the whole range of Dzogchen masters he's trained with, but I know Dingo Kenzin Rinpoche and Kenpo Jime Punso, two of the greatest masters of the 20th century. He's made this comment, because his training, his primary training was, of course, in the Galupa, the new translation school. And so there, the most prominent terminology referring to this depth of consciousness is, as I said, the innate mind of clear light, the very subtle mind. Now, as Holland has commented, that even an Arya Bodhisattva, like on the first ground or above, let's say a first ground Arya Bodhisattva, who has incredible bodhicitta, it's way beyond the stage of the path of accumulation preparation, or on the path of seeing here, so it's way up there, Arya Bodhisattva. An Arya Bodhisattva, who has direct non-conceptual, non-dual realization of emptiness, tremendous purity of mind, extraordinary paranormal abilities, and extrasensory perception. And you can read about those in the Abhisamayalankara and so forth. Even an Arya Bodhisattva, on the first ground and right on through, seventh ground and so forth, even an Arya Bodhisattva doesn't realize rigpa. The Arya Bodhisattva realizes emptiness. And then we can ask, with what mind, with what type of mind, what quality, what dimension of awareness does an Arya Bodhisattva realize emptiness? Subtle mind. Having achieved shamatha, of course. You don't get to the first Arya Bodhisattva ground without the union of shamatha vipassana. That kind of goes without saying. So it's the subtle mind, right? It's with the subtle mind that one gains realization of emptiness. That's true for an Arya Bodhisattva. But not with a very subtle mind. The Arya Bodhisattva doesn't have that, doesn't have realization of this by just simply practicing the Paramita Yana, by Sutrayana, practicing just the six perfections, but without any Vajrayana, without Dzogchen, without Mahamudra, just practicing good old-fashioned Mahayana practice, then the Arya Bodhisattva has incredible powers, incredibly compassion, direct realization of emptiness, but is realizing emptiness with a subtle mind, not with rigpa, not with the innate mind of clear light. So even an Arya Bodhisattva doesn't realize rigpa, not if it has simply followed the Paramita Yana. And if we put this again in classic context, think of the three countless eons, you probably heard of that, how long it takes to achieve enlightenment if you're not practicing Vajrayana, Mahamudra, Dzogchen, if you're just following the six perfections. three countless eons, right? Three countless eons. Each one is finite, but it's just really, 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 really long. Okay? One countless eon. From the time that you enter the path, the Mahayana path of accumulation, that's when your bodhicitta becomes spontaneous, effortless, and authentic, and you are a bodhisattva. From that moment until you achieve, the first ground, the first Arya Bodhisattva ground, or bhumi, one countless eon. That's one countless eon. That's many contractions and expansions of the universe. Many. You're an Arya Bodhisattva. That's how long that takes. When you're practicing generosity, ethics, patience, enthusiasm, jhana, of course, and then wisdom, one countless eon to get to the first bhumi, another countless eon to get to the eighth bhumi, and another countless eon to finish off and become Buddha. Right. And so no trivial accomplishment to become an Arya Bodhisattva. But an even Arya Bodhisattva has not realized Rigpa. So this is emphasized to highlight the extraordinary power of Vajrayana. And this is especially highlighting the stage of generation, but above all, the stage of completion. Because it's in the stage of completion, which is based upon very profound realization of stage of generation. Stage of completion, then what you're doing is you're engaging this profound transformation of the body on a subtle energetic level, such that your energies, the pranas, are coming not only into the heart chakra, but into the indestructible drop, the mishika tikle, the indestructible bindu at the heart. So they're all dissolving. Coarse energy is dissolving into subtle. That happens when you shiv shamatha. But subtle into the extremely subtle. That's when all the energies converge into that indestructible drop at the heart, or indestructible bindu. So now all that lingers is the very subtle energy. And that very subtle energy is inextricably conjoined with, or of the same nature as, very subtle mind, which is the innate mind of clear light. And so a highly accomplished adept on stage of completion, who has achieved this degree of realization, then is realizing the innate mind of clear light, realizing Rigpa, and from the perspective of Rigpa, realizing emptiness. So an accomplished adept on the stage of completion realizes emptiness with the very subtle mind, the innate mind of clear light, which sets that person, him or her, above the realization of even an Arya Bodhisattva, who's realizing the same emptiness. There's no difference in the emptiness, but the mind that realizes it, His Holiness is really clear on this point, the mind that realizes it is different. I know this is very esoteric and I'm going to quit soon, but I think for background, for the bigger picture, sometimes helpful to see the grandeur of the path we're talking about here. And so there it is, a person who is well accomplished on the stage of completion realizes emptiness with the innate mind of clear light, which is none other, says His Holiness. Because again, I speak with no authority at all. I can tell you my address, my telephone number. Those things I'm an authority on, not much else. But His Holiness knows a lot of things. The innate mind of clear light and Rigpa are the same. If you realize Rigpa, you would realize the innate mind of clear light. They're the same. And so to realize Rigpa is quite something, quite extraordinary. Dujum Lingpa says that if you're drawn to a more elaborate path, then upon the basis of having achieved shamatha and vipassana, you may, if you like a more elaborate path, then fully venture into a stage of generation and completion. And in the Vajra essence, he lays that out in quite some detail, about 200 or 300 pages worth. So he really unpacks it beautifully. It's a masterpiece. So for those drawn to a more elaborate path, there it is, full-fledged stage of generation, the whole mandala and the five Buddha families and all of that. And then he goes into tummo and various other stage of completion practices, all designed to get the coarse energies to dissolve into the subtle into the very subtle, into the indestructible bindu at the heart, realizing emptiness. So this is something like Milarepa did, and that is realizing emptiness with that innate mind of clear light, right? So he said, and then on that basis, then you venture into the breakthrough, tekchu. And on that basis, having mastered the tekchu, then you venture into the direct crossing over. And then you become Buddha in one lifetime. There's a great transference rainbow body, a great transference rainbow body, a little rainbow body, little rainbow body. That's where you just shrink and shrink and shrink and shrink until there's only, and with nice rainbow lights coming out and leaving only your hair and nails behind. That's the little rainbow body. The big rainbow body is a bit more impressive. The great transference rainbow body. That's for people of sharp faculties. Oh. So for those who are drawn to a more elaborate path, then there's a shamatha, vipassana, stage of generation, stage of completion, and then tekchut and tutgel. But he said for those who are not drawn to elaboration, drawn to more concise, simple, straight, unelaborated path, then shamatha, vipassana, tekchut and tutgel, he said that will suffice. That is enough. But either way, the realization of rikpa is there on the basis of the realization of emptiness. So realizing rikpa is quite something. And each of these levels, the realization of shamatha, just shamatha, access to the first jhana, so much benefit that you see along the way, with a lot of ups and downs, of course, but the purifying process of overcoming those five obscurations. You don't have to be told from outside whether you're doing it. You can see for yourself, is ill will subsiding? Is sensual craving or craving, you know, any attachment for hedonic pleasures of any kind, is that subsiding? Excitation, anxiety, guilt, subsiding or not? Laxity and dullness, subsiding or not? Afflictive uncertainty, subsiding or not? You don't have to ask somebody outside. They're all getting subdued, they're all going dormant as you progress along the path of shamatha, let alone the arising of great stability and clarity. When you gain realization of emptiness, the benefits are far beyond that of shamatha, almost like incomparable. Because now your mental afflictions are really getting cut off. You're bringing about really irreversible transformation in the mind, purification. So the benefits of realization of emptiness are far greater. And they actually can get to the point of irreversibility through vipassana, which is really the whole point of vipassana. And so you can imagine if the benefits of vipassana, insight into emptiness, far surpass those of mere shamatha, then the realization of rikpa far surpasses the benefits of merely, I hesitate even to say the phrase, merely realizing emptiness. Because you're realizing something, you know, that is, well, the ultimate ground of samsara and nirvana. And emptiness is equivalent to nirvana. So in the realization of rikpa, you are realizing the one taste of samsara and nirvana. If you're not, then you're not realizing rikpa. And emptiness is nirvana. So you're getting one half the equation, but when you're realizing emptiness, you're not realizing samsara. And you're not realizing the common ground. You get the common ground, the one taste of samsara and nirvana, only by realizing rikpa. So the benefits of that far outshine even the benefits of realizing emptiness. Quite extraordinary. So I was boning up, doing a little bit of reading, I have to confess. But there was one contemporary of Padmasambhava and Vimalamitra. I think his name was Namda Dingzin Zangbo. Because I just was checking out how many people have achieved this great transference rainbow body. And he apparently was one who invited Vimalamitra to Tibet. And he suggested to King Tiso Denzin that he invite Padmasambhava to Tibet. So quite pivotal there, very key figure, a minister to the king. And so these tremendous adepts, Padmasambhava, Vimalamitra, they both came, of course. Both of them achieved great transference rainbow body. They're famous for that. But this minister who invited them, he did too. And how did he do it? How did he achieve great transference rainbow body? By practicing for 55 years, died at the age of 126, I think it was. 55 years. And then the body completely dissolving into, you know, all materiality dissolving. And yet he's not died. And so he's maintaining the form, but as a form of pure energy of primordial consciousness. And so he was one. So 55 years, 8 weeks. Maybe it's time to be patient. This is a little teaspoon. The teaspoon's too grandiose. I gave you a little eyedropper. A little eyedropper. Oh. Eyedropper? If you don't know now, it's too late to ask. You know. There we are. So, there was a long preamble, but hopefully that will serve you well, that there's the big picture. And I think the big picture, and what I've said, there was no opinion there. That was all just straight teachings from His Holiness Dalai Lama and other great adepts of the past and the current and the contemporary scene. So nothing novel. If I added anything novel, it would almost certainly be false because it would be my own. But the big picture is very helpful to place things into context. It makes the mind very spacious. And then we come back and say, okay, if you're feeling really stressed out, then go in the infirmary. Ah, right? A step in the right direction. and then right on through all the way up to resting in Rigpa. If that can be your shamatha practice, where you're actually discovering shamatha from within the context of Rigpa, glory, hallelujah. My hat is off to you. Fantastic. Okay, so that said, right now you're either really stressed out and the mind is agitated and drained, in which case there are the yoga mats, but choose your own method. So for this afternoons, for the rest of this week, just invite you to choose your own method, having taken your own pulse, attentionally, cognitively, and then find what's most suitable for you. Okay, let's have one silent session. Ona so. So as far as I can tell, I think those are the final Dharma talks. Hope so. But wrapping up, kind of summing up and looking for transition in terms of the four measurables and then in terms of the three methods of shamatha and possibly enhanced with realization of emptiness and rikpa on top of that. So there was a big picture and all of these can be applied not only during but after the retreat. So I think from now on we'll have much more time for a question and answer, and there are some, just three here. I will read them and see if I'll do my very best to give a concise answer to each. When I practice attention to breathing, the power of thoughts to distract me, be they coarse or subtle, seems less to do with their content or reference than to the currents of prana that seem to underlie and propel them. Very good insight. And it's very much of a Vajrayana insight in particular. Bear in mind, Theravada Pali Canon makes no references to prana as such. But in Vajrayana, it's very big time, and there are the many, many types of prana, the coarse prana. They do, from a subtle physiological basis, they do arouse a lot of just the rumination. So it's not just that we're attached to this and attached to that cognitively, but there's a real a subtle physiological substrate to this. So it's a good insight. So gradually relaxing and refining the breath is very helpful to quiet them, but this can be slow and inefficient. Okay, that's, of course, slow and efficient always relative to what? If you have another method, heavens to Betsy, you know, practice it. If you know something that's faster and more efficient, then why mess around with mindfulness of breathing? Having said that, the Buddha, among the 40 different shamatha methods that he taught in the Pali Canon, highlighted mindfulness of breathing as the most effective one for overcoming rumination. So I think that probably should not be dismissed too casually. Is there some more direct pranic practice, perhaps similar to tsalung, that can be of help? Well, the gentle vas breathing. It's a good question, perfectly good question. The gentle vas breathing is a tsalung practice. Tsa means nadis, or the channels through which the energy courses. Lung is the prana. And so the gentle. So here we are, I think all of us behaving as responsibly as we can. So in terms of tsalung practices, the only one I teach or ever teach in a public setting like this is this gentle vas breathing, because it's so safe. There are far more demanding ones, and if you want to see how demanding, then check out the movie The Yogis of Tibet. And if you can, you know, jump 4 feet up into the air and while in mid-air come down, landing in full lotus, while holding your breath and while maintaining a visualization, then you get some idea what tsalung practice on a professional level is. It ain't easy, and it's really for young people. So you young studs and studdesses, you may be able to do it, but geezers like me, I'm over the hill. I mean, I did practice about 20 years ago, but still a bit over the hill. So it's really something for young people, you know. So could that help? Yes, yoga could help. The whole tradition of asanas, of the Hatha yoga, that's all designed to prepare your body. In the Hindu tradition, the whole practice of pranayama is designed to refine, to shape, to direct the pranas so that they don't act against you. And so the Hindu tradition is very rich there. But again, coming back to the Buddhist tradition, I mean, the Buddha certainly, he was certainly aware of all of the contemplative technology of his era. I mean, maybe it's a little bit of a leap of faith, but he was very savvy. And he certainly knew about pranayama techniques, and in the Pali Canon, he didn't teach any. He simply taught mindfulness of breathing, which, as I've mentioned before, is, to my mind, really kind of a natural pranayama, allowing the breath to settle into its own rhythm, and in so doing, by the breath to the prana, refining, calming, equalizing the prana. So mission accomplished, but without getting in there and trying to outsmart your respiration cycle, but let your body outsmart you. So bottom line is, mindfulness of breathing is strongly highlighted in all Indo-Tibetan traditions, including Tibetan tradition, including Vajrayana. There's from the Manjushri Mula Tantra. So here, full-fledged Vajrayana Tantra. In this tantra, the question comes up, and how do you calm rumination? By counting the in and out breaths. So if that were just for dumbbells or people of dull faculties and so forth, you know, those other people, it wouldn't be there in the Vajrayana. It wouldn't be in a tantra. So I think it's, you know, whatever works, mindfulness breathing can be very helpful for directly subduing them, but that together with a good diet that is really appropriate to physiology, the right type of exercise, qigong can be very good, tai chi can be very good, yoga is expressly designed to help you with your samadhi, calming rumination. A devotional practice can be very, very helpful. Guru Yoga, taking refuge, bodhicitta, four immeasurables. When the Buddha lists, I think it was 11 qualities, 11 benefits of cultivating loving kindness, your mind settles easily in samadhi. That's one of them. Right? The mind's so peaceful, so benign, so benevolent, so gentle, that too will have its impact. So come in from every which way. And then, of course, the coming in from another angle, settling the mind as a natural state, and that is not trying to subdue them. You know, as tempting as that is, but simply attending to them, kiting into the wind of them, and allowing them to dissolve themselves. So it's another skillful means. And having said that, I've never implied and never believed that the three shamatha methods that I'm highlighting here are the best for everybody, or they're simply the best, or you shouldn't go outside of that. That's just crazy. To believe that would be just crazy. And I'm not that crazy. So for some people, for possibly focusing on a bindu. Now, I won't teach this, and I don't encourage you to do it without a really qualified teacher. Because this one you really want to be monitored carefully for a sustained period, especially if you're kind of going professional, practicing 8, 10, 12 hours a day. Then you really want a teacher on hand, right? But one of those, so I'll talk about it, but I'm not teaching it, is to visualize a bindu of light right in the middle of your heart chakra. Single-pointedly focused there. It can be white, it can be deep blue, whatever you like. There are teachings on that. I've translated a number of them. I've practiced somewhat, so I know how to do it. But boy, you do that. Do that. And as long as you really have a very virtuous mind coming to it, so spend a lot of time, refuge, bodhicitta, guru yoga, then you venture into this. You might even do it in the context of state of generation practice, generating, dissolving yourself, generating yourself as a deity, like Avalokiteshvara. And then focusing single-pointedly on a bindu right in the center of your heart chakra. If you can do that and not start getting tight, not seizing up, but do it spaciously, relaxed, at ease, single-pointedly, by focusing your attention there on this bright, so this luminous point of light, or a little orb of light in the center of your heart chakra, that is just like a flame attracting moths, and that it just draws the prana. It's like a straw. It draws the prana right into the central channel and draws them up. It's really like a straw, and your mouth is right there at the bindu at your heart. It's drawing the pranas right in there. Well, if you can do that, if you can really, by the power of your samadhi, draw the pranas from the two secondary channels into the central channel and draw them right up into the heart chakra, welcome to the substrate consciousness. Because when they dissolve there, your mind has dissolved into substrate consciousness. Because that's where they can converge, in deep sleep, right? When you faint, go comatose, when you die, and when you achieve shamatha. So that's a very powerful technique. Very, very powerful. And that's why I'm not teaching it. Because if you do it wrong, you can really screw yourself up. Do major damage. When I was in Pune, 1981, training in yoga with Iyengar, there was one fellow, I was staying at a Christian ashram as a Buddhist monk studying with a Hindu yogi. And my roommate was a Western Zen guy. We were both about the same age, 30 or so. And he had been really hardcore, one of these people that, you know, no pain, no gain, just driving, driving, driving. Age of 30, he had already had 3 heart attacks. They couldn't have been very severe. He was still up and walking, but, you know, I would really like you not to do that. That's why I'm not teaching that practice. It's a marvelous practice. It's a profound practice. But have a really accomplished teacher. And not only teaching, I can teach it to you, but have one who is monitoring you, staying in the same retreat center, overseeing you, and then that can be terrific, really powerful. If you seize up, it can really do major damage. Okay? So there's that. That's one of many, many marvelous practices. Hola, so. Then one from Andreas. CWR. Can you just tell me what CWR is? Huh? It looks like CWR. Spoke on this in private. Oh, we. Aha. We. Okay, gotcha. Qui. Okay. We spoke, so I can read it out loud, yes? Okay. That's why you put your name on it. I'm assuming if your name's on it, I can say your name. So we spoke on this private, but maybe it can be relevant to mentioned in the group. Could you speak on the difference between commitment and... Yes, I remember. Commitment and attachment, that is, in relation to one's partner, children, and friends. What is the difference between the word attachment as used in Buddhist context and the more general use of the term in English? Very good. Sorry. That's a very rich question. So, bearing in mind, in the Buddhist context, we're always translating from Pali, Sanskrit, Chinese, Tibetan, but from some really solid Buddhist language that has centuries of track record behind it. So I only have familiarity with Sanskrit, Pali, and Tibetan. really good scholars will nail down their Chinese and Japanese and so forth, and they'll be fluent in all of them, unlike me. But when using the word attachment, this is direct translation from the Sanskrit or Pali, whatever, and it's always, of course, you've heard this before, but it's defined as a mental affliction. If it's not a mental affliction, if it's not rooted in delusion, if it's not clinging to and exaggerating the qualities of its object, then we just don't call it attachment, right? So attachment, by definition, is a mental affliction, and what that means, when you say something is a klesha, a mental affliction, the definition of mental affliction, this is really helpful, this is very useful. There's all kinds of mental afflictions, from delusion, craving, hostility, envy, and the list goes on and on, primary and secondary mental afflictions. But what they all have in common is they disrupt the equilibrium of the mind. In Tibetan, sem mashi wa cheli cheki semjung, it's a mental factor that has as its function the disruption of the mind, or the taking away of the peace of the mind, mashiwa chepa. It disturbs, it disrupts the mind. And so it will do that cognitively by causing us to misapprehend the nature of reality, as when we're caught up in the grip of attachment or craving. So cognitively, but also then emotionally, or we get caught in the grip of an emotion, so we slip into a refractory period. So by definition, then attachment is always self-centered. It's rooted in the reified sense of I am. So it's always fundamentally about me, in relationship to person, things, places, and so forth and so on. Whereas when we use this word commitment, I think probably in all of our European language, if you just say the word commitment, at least from my ear, it immediately has a positive connotation. Positive connotation. If a person, such and such can't make a commitment, okay, why? Is it a character flaw? What's your problem? What's the problem? Like, as if there is a problem. Maybe there isn't. But when you say, this person made a real commitment, well, of course, we hope to something good, not commitment to making weapons of mass destruction and so forth. But what you're getting at, I will try not to be too elaborate here, a commitment to, again, a romantic partner, a friend, children, family, and so forth, is when it's wholesome, and let's leave out the unwholesome ones. They're not interesting, right? A wholesome relationship, good friendship, a loving partnership, a loving marriage, a romantic relationship with or without their certificate, then commitment that is at least not heavily conditioned by attachment. We're not going to speak about extremes, absolutely yes or no, but not heavily conditioned by self-centered attachment is a commitment to another person for that person's sake. For that person's sake, coming out of a genuine concern, an affection, I'll say a sense of commitment to this person's well-being, that if the person comes down with a serious illness or has an injury or is in a really bad mood or sometimes just flies off the handle and says something really harmful, abusive, what have you, it happens. You know, sometimes the mind just falls under domination of mental affliction. What can we say? We're still vulnerable. But when we're committed to them, we say, yesterday you flew off the handle, you got really upset and you said some really angry things, but it passed. The commitment's there. Not just when you're really pleasant and agreeable and attractive and all that. It's a commitment that I am your friend, I'm your companion, your partner, your husband, your wife, your parent, your child, and so forth. Through thick and thin, you can count on me. So it's not that I can count on you. If I'm committed to you, this means you can come out, you can count on me in times of need, in times of joy and sorrow, adversity and felicity. So a very wholesome thing. Among mundane virtues in Tibetan culture, because it's just a society, right? And different societies value different kind of virtues as really high virtues. In some, it might be heroic, macho, you know? Like, I don't know, maybe the Trojans. Maybe, you know, the great virtue, I don't know, I'm guessing here, but the Trojans, masculinity, strength, courage, valor in the face of battle, and all of that, that might be the highest virtue. Whereas in Tibetan tradition, just in terms of mundane virtues, one of the ones they highlight a lot is mi tempo. This person's reliable. Reliable. If the person says he's going to do something, he does it. If he says he's your friend, then he's your friend through thick and thin. If your husband, your wife, and so forth, this person you can count on. They say, now that's a virtue that we really value. Dembo mena, if you're flaky, if you vacillate, can't count on you, don't know what's your mood today, what's it went like that, then they don't rely. So that's really kind of one of the basic ones. So that's something like that. And commitment absolutely does not necessarily entail attachment. It often does. And then we just try to, you know, tease out the attachment. But it doesn't necessarily by any means. Commitment to a gang, and this is, I know this is unfortunate, but gangs, like in, we have gangs all over the world, but, you know, teenagers and so forth, they get into really harmful and violent activity. They may be very committed to each other. You know, we're brothers, let's share some blood or something. You know, so there's a commitment there, but it's a commitment now within the group of my side against your side, against the other gang and so forth. So within it, it looks very nice until you meet the other gang and you find, this commitment was only to do group violence. Then it's a problem. It happens all the time in war, all the time in war, where today is Memorial Day in the United States, so Memorial Day remembering all of the people who fought in the various wars of the United States. And it tends to be, I'm not unpatriotic, but it tends to be a sympathy only for the people on one's own side. That's attachment. Never mind how many died on the other side. That's their problem. You have your own Memorial Day. We won't care about it, though, and it won't be our national holiday. So there's, but the Bodhisattva commitment is to all sentient beings. So there we go, no attachment. Okay? Could the idea of non-attachment misunderstood be used to justify the avoidance of commitment and responsibility leading to a life of no clear sense of direction? Boy, I can finally give a short answer. Emphatically, yes. And you know that lack of attachment can be simply one more the avoidance of commitment and so forth, but coming out of non-attachment or in some idea of non-attachment can really be a perfect case, a prime case of aloof indifference. Aloof indifference may have very little attachment except to oneself quietly, but out of aloof indifference then be refusing to have any commitment to anybody and say, oh no, I'm a Buddhist. Oh, too bad. So very good, very thoughtful and practical questions. Oh, Lasso. My final one written, and then we can hopefully, whoops, I'm going to read this one just so we can get, let's see if I can at least read it. While not a path unto themselves and fraught with the potential for misuse, psychedelics have nevertheless long played important roles in the human quest to understand consciousness and the universe in some cultures. In Tibet, I just don't see any reference to it at all, except for, you know, I just don't, not as part of the path at all. So I don't think so in Christianity either. I don't know Judaism. I don't think so. So in some, yeah, sure. I mean, Native Americans, yes. Some, but then not all. So this is very selective. There are substances and traditions that date back millennia, as well as the dazzling array of modern synthetics whose use is in professional therapeutic context was as brief as it is promising. It's coming up, it's coming back a little bit. I follow the news, and they're finding more and more medical benefits of marijuana. And also, one graduate student that I used to be working with on the Shamatha Project is now off in Washington, D.C., studying the effects of psilocybin legally. And then somebody else I read recently studying LSD and the possible therapeutic effects of that for overcoming, I don't know, some kind of mental problems. So it's there. It's very carefully guarded, but it is there. Considering their ability to break limited and ingrained notions of reality and open the doors of perception, what role, if any, can such substances play as tools to open, deepen, reveal, or inspire spiritual practice? I'm not a good person to ask for that. And that is, a long time ago, decades and decades ago, I did, you know, in my very late teens, up to the age of 21, experimented with substances. Since this is being taped, I'll just say substances. You know, brown sugar, caramel. And found them really quite interesting. Enjoyable, mostly, sometimes not, just occasionally not. But not just enjoyable like chocolate. But yeah, open doors of perception, showing an alternate vision of reality. Found it helpful. I can't say I regret it. It really showed me, showed me kind of a heightened a luminosity, kind of a non-duality, but an extreme vividness of awareness. I never did, in fact, I don't remember hallucinating at all, but really heightened awareness, really savored, kind of an intense, sheer raw intensity of experience. Like, that's what it could be. And then just in my own personal narrative, then from the time that I bought my one-way ticket to India, the age of 21, I just had no interest. No interest whatsoever. And I've never had any interest, personally. And I read about it from afar. one old friend of mine who, I think he's still alive, he really took as his path, taking ecstasy and a wide array of psychedelics. He was one of the generation of Timothy Leary, did it, and he was so keen on it. He again and again said, Alan, you'd really find this mind-blowing. You'd really, really, you should take it. And I just was never interested. It's not like I think, oh, no, that's inherently evil. I just had no interest, and I still don't. So there are people who have immensely more interest than I, interest and experience than I do. And I'll tell you why. So I don't have any moral judgment about it. Like, no, it's intrinsically bad, shouldn't do it, I'm a Buddhist, or it's really, really good, you should try it. I don't say either one. But I have hung around with or collaborated with neuroscientists, some really world-class neuroscientists, since 1992, so 20 years and more. And the brain is so immensely complex. I mean, really, one can say inconceivably complex. What is 100 billion neurons? And then when you start counting all the synapses, all the connections, the numbers just go astronomical of the complexity of all the connections among the neurons, let alone what those glial cells are doing, and there's lots and lots of them as well. And so just given the enormous complexity of the brain and the fact that, you know, for all the splendor of modern neuroscience, and it is fantastic, it's so brilliant, the technology is getting better and better, and any good neuroscientist will say, hey, we're on our baby steps here. This is a superb discipline, a brilliant science in its infancy. There is so much we don't know, let alone the profound issues of mind-brain relationship, just brain-brain relationships, and the role of genetics and epigenetics and neuroplasticity and all of these. But it is so complex to introduce into that a drug that you get illegally by somebody who don't know, who's breaking the law and making them and selling them, trusting your brain to such a person who may be mafia, maybe, you know, part of some drug cartel, who knows where, who maybe shoots people that you don't like, and those are the people belonging to drug cartels, you're going to take ultimate refuge in them to entrust your brain to them? Why not just entrust your brain to people on Wall Street? You know, if you want people who, you know, I mean, I know there must be very good people on Wall Street, but they're not known for, you know, extraordinary ethics, and neither are the people who are running drug labs and drug cartels and so forth. So of all the people, I would think, okay, in whom do I want to entrust my most precious organ? Man, they'd be on the bottom of the list. They'd be below plumbers and architects and, you know, people who clean out your drains. Because at least it's an honest living. And they, you know, an honest buck for an honest work. But people doing this, and you can entrust your brain to it, you can put that, your chemical in your brain. And this is with, you know, neuroscientists not really knowing what are the lingering effects, because it's so complex. If it's a natural substance, like psilocybin, marijuana, and so forth, could be a bit better than these synthetic drugs. But then, of course, the fact that something's natural doesn't mean exactly healthy. Cyanide is natural. Arsenic is natural. Dadura, drive you crazy, is natural. You know, so the many, many things that are natural, they grow in nature, but they were never meant for human consumption. And so that's why. And then for me, again, it may have use. It may have use. And I'll let other people who have such trust in the pharmaceutical industry and in drug cartels and are willing to entrust their most precious organ to such people. If you have that kind of boldness, I'm a chicken myself. Total wimp. But as a Dharma practitioner, I guess I really would call myself that. There was always, whenever even a little tiny murmuring of kind of temptation came when my dear friend kept on trying to get me to take ecstasy and so forth, which I've never taken, just the little quiet voice in me spoke and said, if I were to take ecstasy or cocaine or heroin or morphine and so forth, I've never taken any of those. If I were to take it and I liked it, I would want to take it again. I like dark chocolate, so I like to eat it again, and then I eat it again and then again because I like it, right? So if I took one of those drugs and I really liked it, I'd want to take it again. And having taken it twice, I'd want to take it again and again. And even if it doesn't create a physical dependence like heroin or cocaine, I've now just opened the door with my eyes wide open to a psychological dependence. That when everything goes wrong, or I'm a little bit, my practice isn't going as fast as I wanted to, as quickly, as efficiently, and so forth, but I could take some drug and maybe it'll go better. That will always be in the mind. I don't want that in the mind. I don't want that. I'd rather have it coming from ethics, from motivation, from the four immeasurables, from gentle cultivation, gradual, sane, transparent cultivation of the heart and mind, rather than taking some alien substance, popping into my brain and hoping for the best. And that's if I liked it. Now, when I was taking substances 42 years ago, on one occasion, I remember, one occasion quite clearly, I was taking it where, strangely enough, it was intensely illegal, what I was taking. And we knew that if we got caught by the cops, it would be a long prison sentence just for taking it. It was not the United States. And so we took it, and I was just wired the whole time, just waiting for the cops to come in, you know. Boy, that was not fun. And so that was the last time I took it in that country. You know, and so that was a really one bum trip I ever had, just waiting for, and I heard about their jails. I'm keeping the country anonymous, but I thought, wow, I'd like not to have a long stay there. And so I did it foolishly once and decided that's enough. That was not fun. So if you take any of these drugs and you don't like it, you take any of the drugs and you don't like it, then why take it in the first place, right? Because you didn't like it. You went out of your way to do something probably illegal and you didn't like it. So then why bother? But if you do like it, then you want to do it again and again and again. So I just thought, I don't want either one. I don't want to like it. I don't want to dislike it. I just rather skip the whole thing and go the old tortoise fashion. You know, ethics, samadhi, wisdom, bodhicitta, stage of generation, you know, the old-fashioned way. So that's it. So I have a really boring response, whoever asked the question. And I noticed that one was anonymous. So I hope you see there's no moral judgment there. If people get benefit from it, and maybe they got the drug from, you know, the National Institute of Mental Health because they're taking it in Washington, D.C. and in a carefully controlled. If it can be benefit, I'm happy. Maybe benefit. It's just not the way I want to get benefited. Because that's the thing about drugs, and that is, it's drugs always short-circuit. It's a detour around a little thing called ethics. It's always a detour around that. Whenever you take drugs, does anybody ever ask you, are you avoiding the 10 non-virtues? Are you avoiding harmful action of body, speech, and mind? Are you developing the four immeasurables and benevolence and altruism? Oh, then you can take our drug. Do they ever say that? The drug cartels? it just seems like it just makes ethics irrelevant. It makes motivation irrelevant. Irrelevant. Because you can just take the drug. Now, I know perfectly well, you know, that the context in which you take the drug can have a major impact on your experience. It's not just a chemical on the brain. It's a chemical on the brain in an environment. There's no question about that. It's a true statement. Nevertheless, drugs bypass ethics. And so that sounds a little bit dangerous. Now that we're getting the high-tech people involved. High-tech people. I think didn't come up a couple of weeks ago. Now they got some cap you can put on. Some cap. It's absolutely invasive. I mean, it's some, I don't know, I think it's messing with the electricity in your brain. But it's a cap you put on. It's not a drug. It's something you put on, and it goes directly into the brain, and it enhances your attention skills. Sound really good? Where do you think it's being used? By the military to make really good snipers. I don't want attention that way. I'd rather go the snail's pace. I'd rather spend 10 years developing the first stage rather than short-circuit in a way that has nothing to do with ethics. I don't trust that. And I don't know why anybody else would either. So all the shortcuts, the little gimmicks, the invasiveness on the brain, whether from drugs, electrical stimulus, and so forth and so on, not for me. Not for me. It's part of the beauty of shamatha and the dhyanas, is that if you go the old-fashioned route, which has been around for centuries, of course, and you develop the stability and vividness of attention in that way, rooted in ethics, then if by some strange quirk, some abnormality in your mind, something comes up and a mental affliction gets a hold of you, which it can, even after you've achieved jhana, you're not immune, right? Like Devadatta, the Buddha's cousin, right? Like Devadatta achieved not only shamatha but all the four jhanas. That's pretty impressive. And having achieved all four jhanas, he had some pretty impressive paranormal abilities, which he was quite happy to display. And he did. It's written there in the Pali Canon. So he was no, you know, no amateur when it came to samadhi. All four jhanas, paranormal abilities. And then that psychological virus got hold of his mind of jealousy, of envy towards his cousin, the Buddha. And then out of envy, he asked the Buddha, because the Buddha was rather old at the time, he actually suggested to the Buddha, can you imagine this? He suggested to his cousin, wouldn't you like to retire? Because I've got some really good ideas of how to reform the Sangha, and I have some new precepts I'd like to add. And you're getting quite long on the tooth. And so, Buddha, why don't you step down? I'll take over if you like. You know, we're blood. I'm cousin. Keep it in the family. You know, as if he's running some big, family business. And pass it on to a relative anyway, if it's going to be a hierarchy. And that really took some guts. And the Buddha told him in absolutely no uncertain terms, no. In which case, his response was get pissed. And getting pissed, being angry, turned to malevolence, to ill will, wanting to then to assassinate the Buddha. As his buddy, or Ajatasattu, decided to and did succeed in killing his father and became king. And so there was two buddies. One wanted temporal power, the other one wanted spiritual power. And Devadatta on multiple occasions did try to kill the Buddha. Of course, never succeeded. But as soon as that malevolence arose, ill will, that's ill will exactly, wanting to kill, that's ill will. When that arose, by the power of that arising and getting dominant, becoming a refractory period, a long one, he lost his jhana and he lost his paranormal abilities. So then he had to kill him the old-fashioned way, just as a thug would do. But he couldn't use mind powers to try to kill the Buddha because he lost them as soon as, of course, one of the five obscurations became dominant, then you lose. So that's a built-in safeguard. I really love that about shamatha and the jhanas, is that as long as your mind is virtuous and the powers come up, good, you will use them because you have a virtuous mind. But if you lose a virtuous mind and the mind becomes dominated by ill will or what have you, then you'll lose your jhana, you'll lose your shamatha and lose all the powers that go with it, in which case, if you want to do bad things, you just have to do the old-fashioned way, hitting people or shooting an arrow at them or something stupid like that. So I find that really reassuring, that this really straight path we're following here cannot be misused. It's got its own safety device built in, that if you want to misuse, then you'll lose it. Quite beautiful. And not because God said so or Buddha will punish you. It's just right built into the system. So, there we are. Okay, so that was it. That was the last Dharma talk that I have in mind. And a little bit long questions. We are obviously over time. But so, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Hopefully I'll keep it really short. And then we'll have as much time as necessary to talk about very important things of transition and so forth, any lingering details or points of clarification that I can help you with. That's what I've been here for all along. Happy to do so. But right now, let's go have some hedonic pleasure, if that's available. Have a good night. See you tomorrow.